Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, with occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Democrat Susana Mendoza, Republican Jack McInerney, and Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago. Tonight's program coming to you from our home base, the SiriusXM studios on Chicago's Great West Side, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. Also, your email comments, always welcome at btb@museum.tv. That's btb@museum.tv. That is a relatively new email address, but we look forward to hearing from you this evening as the program unfolds. We've got 2 hours of lots of things to discuss this evening. Obviously, we'll be talking about the Roland Burris controversy in Illinois, but we'll be talking about that in context to the much bigger story, which is the federal stimulus package, the efforts by the Obama administration to provide support for those caught up in the housing crisis, and also how we bail out banks and how we bail out the automobile industry. Lots going on, obviously, with the historic $787 billion economic stimulus package, which has now been signed. And we have governors and mayors all over the United States licking their chops to get a piece of the federal action. And in hour number two, we will be joined by the mayor of Sacramento, California, Kevin Johnson, the former star with the Phoenix Suns, now the mayor of Sacramento. We'll be joining and talking to him at the beginning of our second hour for those listening to us on radio. But I would like to begin by talking about a moment. This was an important broadcast moment or cable moment this past week that has become fodder for discussion on water coolers and all over the United States. And it was when the frustration of one reporter, Rick Santelli, a reporter for CNBC, spilled over in the wake of the announcement by the Barack Obama administration about their unveiling their new plan to help those who are caught up in the housing crisis. Let's take a listen to what he said. It's one of the hottest items that's currently running on YouTube. Let's take a listen to it briefly, and then we're going to discuss it and its implications for our discussion and the discussion of economic stimulus all over the United States. Here's what Rick said.
The government is promoting bad behavior because we certainly don't want to put stimulus forth and give people a whopping $8 or $10 in their check and think that they ought to save it. And in terms of modifications, I'll tell you what, I have an idea. You know, the new administration's big on computers and technology. How about this, president and new administration? Why don't you put up a website to have people vote on the internet as a referendum to see if we really want to subsidize the losers' mortgages, or would we like to at least buy cars and buy houses in foreclosure and give them to people that might have a chance to actually prosper down the road, and reward people that could carry the water instead of drink the water.
Hey, Rick,
that's a novel idea.
Hey Rick, did you?
What? Who thought of that?
They're like putty in your hands. Did you hear?
No, they're not, Joe. They're not like putty in our hands. This is America. How many of you people want to pay for your neighbor's mortgage that has an extra bathroom and can't pay their bills? Raise their hand.
How about we all?
President Obama, are you listening?
How about we all stop paying our mortgage? It's a moral hazard.
Well, that was the heat that was disseminated by cable television. Susana Mendoza is our Democrat. And the broader discussion that I would like to focus on in hour number one is the federal programs that we are discussing, are they rewarding bad behavior by banks, bad behavior by those that take mortgages and can't pay them and probably should have known at the beginning that they couldn't pay them?
Well, I think it's just not that black and white of an issue. One could say that we are rewarding bad behavior. I certainly think that you could find plenty of examples where that would be the case. There's also people that really need help out there. And I think people that made mistakes along the way who were victims of bad behavior from the people who knew more than they did and should have known not to take advantage of people. And so I think I can look at the big picture and say that there's two sides to that coin. But look, I mean, I know the reporter got very, very excited about that, and certainly a lot of us can relate to his feelings. But I get just about as excited when I hear about banks getting billions of dollars of federal money, that's all of our money, and then going out and having lavish parties at the expense of the taxpayer. And so we don't hear as much outrage about that when we continue to bail them out down the line.
Jack McInerney is our Republican. Jack, do you think there's more outrage against the person that may have defaulted on a mortgage or a banker who's making too much money and being bailed out for basically running their bank into the ground?
Right. Well, I was in the stock index trading business for 17 years. When the government gives $45 billion to somebody called the Bank of America, when the stock market recognizes them as having a market capitalization of $19 billion, that basically tells you that the government is throwing a lot of money at a situation that they can never recover from. As far as an individual who may have gotten an adjustable rate mortgage, they borrowed 90% instead of 80%. You can feel some sympathy for them when their equity falls by 40% due to overall market forces that they had nothing to do with. It's one of those Wall Street should have known better. Main Street got walloped by it.
Insofar as the way this is playing out in the body politics, Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago, is this a situation where it may be easy to pick on the unknown person who may have bought a home that they can't afford? And first of all, how many people really did that? And how many people were victims of a system, as Jack just described it, which is a little less sinister than what Rick Santella was talking about?
Well, both things are true. There were a lot of people who bought homes with zero down on liar's mortgages and all the rest. The only thing that the banks expected to happen out of this, first of all, the banks expected to profit by selling the paper to somebody who didn't know better. And secondly, everybody expected housing prices to go up. And when the housing prices went up,
forever,
even though you put nothing down, you would now have equity in the house. The real problem is that once the housing prices started falling, you had lots of people who were overextended. They got wiped out immediately, and then the couple next door who were paying their mortgage and doing everything right, they were now underwater. So there's a lot of blame to go around, including blame, a lot of blame at the federal level. The federal government didn't look at the banks in any serious
way.
They've also
encouraged for many, many years the federal government to participate in trying to help those get started in the housing market that may not have been ready for it.
That's exactly right. And that was encouraged by Fannie and Freddie, government agencies that wanted to do it. But Barney Frank was right in the middle of this. And Chris Dodd took a kind of sweetheart loan from one of the worst offenders of all. That, it seems to me, ought to be something that federal attorneys are looking into day and night. I think that that's just outright bribery.
Our telephone number is 1-800-723-8289. The question tonight, do you believe that the recent actions by the federal government, is it rewarding bad behavior? 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Chicago. From Youngstown, Ohio to Phoenix, Arizona, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. 1-800-723-8289 is the telephone number. We're talking about the economic stimulus package. And Susanna, you are a state lawmaker, so people generally around the country would say that the members of the General Assembly are the closest to the voters. Maybe aldermen and councilmen are as well. But you're closer to your voters. What are they going through right now? How bad are things at the level that you deal with people who you represent? Well, and tell people around the country a little bit about the demographics of your area.
Sure. First and foremost, I represent a very modest to low-income community. On the near southwest side of the city of Chicago, it's a high immigrant population, but very hardworking. And we're suffering through a lot of the same problems that I hear from many of my colleagues who share similar constituencies and even those that have wealthier constituencies. We have issues of foreclosure. One of the wards in my district has one of the highest foreclosure rates, which is the 14th ward, of any of the wards in the city of Chicago. We've seen an increased number of foreclosed homes, which, of course, you know, leads to other issues, societal concerns, other than just on the economic side. And so that's a big issue. People are a day or a week away from getting a pink slip. There's this level of stress that I see in my community that I didn't used to see before, frankly, over the 9 years that I've been in office. And I'll give you a really good indicator. 26th Street, for anyone who's from Chicago, 26th Street, it's the heart of the Mexican-American community, second only to Michigan Avenue in cash generated in terms of cash transactions. And for the first time ever, since I'm 36 years old and I've been in that neighborhood every year of my life that, you know, either as a resident or as a tourist. And I have never seen vacant storefronts in 36 years until now. You go down 26th Street, before you could never get a parcel to have a business there because it was so busy. Now you see vacant storefronts on Kedzie and 26th and all the way west on 26th Street. It's unheard of, but it's symbolic not just of my area, but all of Chicago right now.
Because of all the publicity about the economic stimulus package and the buildup to it, what is the level of expectation from the people that you deal with as to the government's solution here? And are the people that you deal with, are they expecting an instant answer, an instant solution to the problems that they have, or do they understand that it may take months or maybe years to recover?
I think, honestly, people understand. At least they're trying to understand. And I've been very forthright with them and tell them that we don't have a lot of good news to tell people right now. We may have signed a $787 billion stimulus package, but that won't take effect immediately. And people need to be patient. And I know it's difficult to ask them to do that, but we're doing the best we can in Springfield with a $9 billion budget that we have to budget deficit we have to grapple with. And we have to tell people right now it's not about new programs. It's not about new spending. It's about trying to play defense and hold on to what we have now.
But how can you be patient if
it's
you're
very
the person?
I understand.
If you're the person who gets the pink slip.
I know. It's so hard. But that's why we're asking people to just be realistic on what the situation is. I don't want to give people false hope, but know that there are programs that will be coming in the pipeline to help those exact people that you're talking about that have been laid off that don't know what to do next.
Susanna, thank you. Jack, tell us about the people that you live with that are within your sphere of influence, and answer the same question. What are their expectations? Because in many cases, you are dealing primarily with a higher, probably economic level than Susanna in your daily life. So I mean,
kind of go up and down the
economic scale.
Okay,
well, tell us about
it. But it's, you know, it's the old joke of it's a recession when your neighbor gets laid off. It's a depression when you get laid off. And being the Irish Catholic that I am, I have a huge amount of cousins, and I kind of gauge my economic national view on how many of my cousins are laid off. And this is the first year that some of them are. And none of them are depending on government subsidies. None of them are depending on the Obama bailout. They are all out there looking for jobs. Yes, it is tough to find a job, and it takes you longer, but it's personal expectations of, will you accept a job that paid you less than your last one? That, I think, is the major question a lot of people are asking.
In your particular case, let's focus on your relatives. Are they white-collar, blue-collar, or
white-collar.
A mix?
They're mixed.
Right. Isn't the general perception of the economic stimulus package, because when people talk about it and they're talking about jobs, they're usually talking about construction jobs. We're going to build roads. We're going to build bridges. Isn't that the blue-collar?
The white-collar got hit worse. The white-collar guys got hit worse in my family.
They got hit worse, but my question is the economic stimulus package, is it doing to white-collar jobs and workers? What's it doing to those folks?
Actually, I think it's hurting them in the long term. Part of the problem with the economic stimulus from my worldview and people who think like me, the 47% who voted for McCain, is that the amount of shovel-ready projects is less than 30% in the stimulus package. There is an $8 billion railway from L.A. to Vegas. They're calling the Sin City Express or something, and that won't happen for years. We've had, 9 recessions since World War II, and they all last about a year to a year and a half. The problem with recessions is you don't know you're in them until you already are for a year. The good thing is you're already out of them by the time you realize it. This recession may end in 6 months. Regardless of the gloom and doom, the hyper spending that's going to take place in 2 years and 3 years is going to be a drag on the economy. That's the real problem here.
Charles, before you jump in with a question, tell us about your sphere of influence.
He's now thinking about his wife, right?
Your students. The students that are paying. But seriously, within the academic community, you live in Hyde Park. You live not far from President Obama. My question to you is, what are their fears? Is it that their 401k is down to 20% or 50% what it was last year? What are their concerns? Do they have jobs? Are they worrying about losing their jobs?
They have
foreclosures.
They have two or three concerns. I think they're less concerned about foreclosure. The first one is that a lot of people, there were huge layoffs in the medical center, for example, just last week. So a number of people do have concerns about layoffs. But I think most of us, I'm a tenured professor, for example, I'm not so concerned about layoffs. But we are deeply concerned about two things. One is all of our retirement is what we've saved and put in the market. That's all down more than 50%. All we have to live off of when we retire is what we've saved and what we've put into those savings. So that's a big issue. The second thing is it's very expensive to go to college. I'm seeing now for the first time lots of students saying, I think I'm going to graduate a semester early. We're on a quarter system, but I'm going to graduate early. I'm going to take one extra course. I'm going to do it for two because I don't want my parents to do this. We're expecting more students to come in and need financial aid. We're expecting all those kinds of changes. There's going to be tremendous pressure on these students. I assume that it places – one of the things they're trying to cut back on is people who are not delivering immediate services like teaching a class. But if you're in the psychiatric services, you've got people coming in who say, my mom just lost her job.
But here's my question. If you're out there and you have a white-collar job or you're in the medical field and you hear about $787 billion, when you talk about jobs in there, because the president wants to create or save 3.5 million jobs, the question is, what kind of jobs are they? Because if you're building a bridge or you're building a sidewalk or whatever, those
None
are blue-collar jobs.
None
where
of us
are
the,
Where
expect,
are those
well,
who lost their jobs?
Absolutely. I think there's an opportunity for, like, with you know, the way the world is moving towards green developments and things like that. I mean, we see that in the stimulus plan. And it's a good opportunity to train people. Part of that includes workforce development and training, because a construction job is not an end-all to anyone. I mean, that's the last thing really you want people is to say, we're going to get you a job for 6 months. I mean, how long are those projects really going to last? You need to be able to train people to be able
jobs,
to
–
exactly.
But it's not just the jobs here. To me, one of the things – and I'd be really interested in your views – when you said, Jack, when you said – these recessions last a year and a half. I sense an abject panic out there that this isn't like recessions in the past.
Are your people
– you're talking about a level of stress that's not like previous recessions.
No, I agree.
That's what people are scared of, Bruce.
I think people don't – this does not seem comfortable. It doesn't seem like, oh, I remember the last time we were here. This is really scary to a lot of people. And it's really scary, like I said, using 26th Street is a perfect example. I mean, that's really, to me, the perfect example, because we've never seen that before. And when you're a small business who has been a productive business for 20 or 30 years, and you're having financial trouble, and now you cannot access loans or money from the business, I mean, from the banking sector, to be able to make your payroll or to pay your vendors, what's happening? All these small businesses are crumbling, and they are the lifeline of our communities.
But in your particular case, because your constituency tends to be in a lower rung of the socioeconomic ladder, and because they may be used to living on less money, scrimping and saving is a way of life to them. It's not new. But to those of you that you're dealing with, and maybe you're dealing with, Jack, this is a different group. If your 401k is dropped 50%, you're starting to scrimp and save. And in your lifetime or adult lifetime, you've never had to do that.
Do they know how to do it? I've asked people that I know, have you changed your spending habits? And to a person, they say that they have. And the irony here is that what the government is asking you to do on the one hand is go out and spend. We need to stimulate things. Right. But what prudent people are trying to do is saying, right. boy, I need to squirrel away as much as I possibly can. I'm not going out to eat tonight. I'm staying in.
I think it's also that dividing line if you're under or over 40, which I believe only one of us at this table is.
Yes. Kidding.
Under.
under.
Yeah, under. Yeah, under. Those
under here. On radio.
Three to one here.
You know, three of us have seen recessions come and go. But to those under 40, they've never actually seen a deep recession. I remember 1974, 75.
That was
brutal and ugly and grim. But this one, I don't think will be that bad.
Speaking about brutal and ugly and grim, we're going to have a word about Illinois politics when we come back.
I'm Bruce Dumont.
From Fayetteville, North Carolina to Little Rock, Arkansas, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8289. Before we get back to discussion, I would like to take a moment to talk about a little stimulus package that the Museum of Broadcast Communications is involved with. We have one of the great television personalities of all time coming back to Chicago. She's a native of Oak Park. It's Betty White, the star of Golden Girls and the Betty White Show and Life with Elizabeth and, of course, the Mary Tyler Moore Show, appearing recently on Boston Legal. She's coming back for a benefit for the Museum of Broadcast Communications on Sunday, March 15th. It's Betty White at the Empire Room of the Palmer House from noon till 2 o'clock. It is a wonderful brunch. You'll meet Betty White in person, complimentary free parking if you want to drive downtown for the event. And again, all you have to do, tickets are $50. It is a benefit for the Museum of Broadcast Communications. You can go to museum.tv on the web, buy your tickets there, or if you'd prefer to call 312-822-0512. That's 312-822-0512. Calls will be starting tomorrow morning. There's nobody there right now. But again, go to museum.tv as well. Brunch with Betty White, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to see a great television personality.
Oh, she's wonderful. She's wonderful, and she's been with us all of our lives, especially those of us who are over 40.
No, I do love Betty White. How can you not?
She is probably the most successful woman in the history of television insofar as the breadth of her career. She's done so many shows. She started in the 50s with her own show, Life with Elizabeth. And again, she's 87 years old. She's as spry as a...
Oh, my gosh, you're kidding me. I spoke with her the other day.
She sounds like she's 32. She's looking forward to coming back because she remembers going to the Empire Room as a little girl with her mother. So she's looking forward to coming back.
Oh, it's a beautiful room. People who haven't been to the Empire
Room, the
Empire Room is just spectacular.
And what they've done to remodel the Palmer House is just one of the most beautiful hotels in all the world. That was Charles Lipsom. He is from the University of Chicago, the pride of Marks, Mississippi, who joins us this evening on our broadcast. Our Republican tonight is Jack McInerney, and he once upon a time ran for lieutenant governor of Illinois in the primary, was unsuccessful, but he's also the head of a television production company called In Time TV, and also you were a trained computer technology.
You talk binary.
So you could go inside a computer and explain how it works. Right. And again, we would lose all of our listeners if that were to happen. And Susanna Mendoza is our Democrat tonight. Susanna is a state representative in Illinois, and she is or was a member of the House Impeachment Committee. Is the House Impeachment Committee still in operation, technically?
Well, technically, we could reconvene it if we had a need to do so, yes.
Oh, if anybody were, for example, to not tell you the full truth in what
I guess.
They say.
But
for
see,
other
my,
politicians.
But so. My point is we should not give that individual, right, the opportunity to repair his prior testimony. I think if you lie, there should be a consequence attached to that.
Right. And we should mention, by the way, for those who are around the country who may not be familiar with the story, Roland Burris, who was appointed to the United States Senate, by former Governor Rod Blagojevich. He testified before the House Impeachment Committee under oath. And then since that oath, he has filed affidavits sort of correcting or amending what he said in that first time. The controversy now is swirling around the state of Illinois. There are many people, including the governor of the state, who have asked for him to resign, as well as the state comptroller and the state treasurer. And again, it has once again put Senator Dick Durbin and Harry Reid in a very difficult situation. because the reason they wanted Roland Burris to go to Springfield to appear before the House Impeachment Committee was to clear up all the questions of who talked to who and whether or not there was any either exchange of money or perceived exchange of money between Governor Blagojevich and Roland Burris before he was selected for the United States Senate. It has clearly embarrassed the state of Illinois. The state is being held up to ridicule. Roland Burris is being pushed and under a great deal of pressure to step down. And I want to say that, Susana Mendoza, this past week you were a guest on Chicago Tonight, which is on WTTW. It's the other public television station in Chicago. And you came out very clearly calling for Roland Burris to step down.
Yes.
Why?
Well, I think it's very simple. He's a former attorney general of this state, so if anyone should know what it means to tell the truth and what that responsibility means to the people of Illinois, it should be a former attorney general who also happens to be a representative of the court. He came before our committee, was asked to do something very simple, which was to say the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And he took an oath to swear to do so. He failed to meet that obligation. And not only did he come before our committee and change his story from his original affidavit, which was sworn under testimony as well, he originally gave us a sworn affidavit that then was contradicted by his sworn testimony before the committee. So that was the second story. And then once he left the committee, and I believe he found out, that could be wrong, but my instinct on this is that it came to his attention that he was taped on one of these taped conversations by the FBI with the brother of Governor Rod Blagojevich. And so at that point, if I'm his attorney and I'm him, I'm thinking, how do I reconcile my testimony before this committee with what the truth really is? And so Senator Reid and Senator Durbin were very clear. They asked him to come before the committee, say everything he knew related to his conversations with anyone related to the appointment or pay-to-play allegations that the governor was under at the time. And he came and he told us as absolutely little as he possibly could. And to me, those were glaring lies of omission. And so, look, it's really simple. People know the difference between the truth and a lie. They try to teach your kids that every single day, right? They tell your kids that if you tell a half-truth, it's equivalent to saying a lie. So I'm just trying to wonder. I'm a little confused as to why we should hold third graders or four-year-olds to a higher standard than we would a sitting U.S. senator or a former attorney general who is sworn under oath. So to me, it's very simple. There's right and there's wrong. He was by far on the wrong side of that issue, and I think there should be penalties associated to that.
And you also made a point on television. You said that when you raise your hand and you say you're going to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, that is what you should do. And again, you made that statement very
Absolutely.
Dramatically. And I will just say that, again, at the beginning of the program, we played a clip of a reporter who was outraged at government action. What we have with Susana Mendoza, we have an elected official who is outraged by the conduct of another politician of her own party. And I mentioned all the people that have subsequently called for Roland Burris to step aside. Susana Mendoza was first. She was joined by her colleague, Jack Franks,
exactly.
who has been a guest on this program. But again, this is a member of the General Assembly. She's not in leadership. Whether or not your political career is injured in some way because you did stand up for what you believed in. And I think you more clearly than any politician that I've heard articulate this issue over the last several weeks, no one hit the ball out of the park like you did. And you're to be congratulated. In my view, you were a profile in courage at a time when we need more people talking about it. And it really is about time that we hear from others' leaders. In fact, today on Meet the Press, they played a clip of White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs. On Friday, he sent a very strong signal to Roland Burris that he should spend part of his weekend really thinking about his future. It was one of the most ominous warnings, certainly from the White House press office, that I've ever seen. But again, there was something interesting that Michelle Norris, of NPR said on Meet the Press today. She said, yes, she said, but, you know, at this particular moment, Mayor Daley has not weighed in on this. He's avoided the situation. It seems to me that when you have the governor, the state treasurer, you have a member of the General Assembly, you have the state comptroller, when you have those people, including some of the United States Senate, suggesting that there's something doesn't sit right here, it seems to me that we need leadership now from the mayor's office. He has been very silent at a time when others are stepping forward and demonstrating great courage at a time when that's exactly what I think we need in the state of Illinois.
We also need senior African-American political officials in this state to weigh in. Without them weighing in first, it's going to be very dangerous for a number of other politicians to weigh in. That's item one. But there is a second item, and that is if he is removed and then a governor who was elected only as a lieutenant governor and reached the top level only because the previous governor, Blagojevich, was impeached, is allowed to appoint a new senator without going to an election, then I don't see...
Well, Governor Quinn, he has joined the call now for a special election. That happened last week?
I would like to see it. I haven't heard Madigan. I haven't heard a lot of the political leaders in Springfield. And, of course, they have one clear problem, which is the Democrat may not win. And the Democrats, he may win.
Charles.
But I really think this is a crucial issue. Burris should resign. He's now being called... instead of D. Illinois in our newspapers, he's being called by one columnist, John Cass, D. Lying Weasel. I mean, how can you overcome that? There's nobody here who has confidence in him. He won't take questions from the press. This is a scandal.
Charles, since 1970, Illinois has indicted, tried, and convicted 1,000 politicians. We are now on our second 1,000 with Mr. Burris. But to just counterpoint that a little bit, yeah, he's a dirtbag and he's a scumbag and all that, fine. We have lots of them in Illinois. But the real
question but, natural.
Of course. as a man from Peoria said, Bishop Fulton Sheehan, every saint has a past and every sinner has a future. Mr. Burris's future may be very short, but he does have however short that is. But the real question is, with 43 states looking at massive deficits, when you have an open Senate seat, are you going to spend $80 million electing somebody? And as the Republican...
It's the most fundamental element of a democracy is you get to elect your officials, including your most senior officials.
We have calls 1-800-723, not only on this subject, but also on the subject that we were discussing in our first sections of the show, and we'll hear those calls when we come back from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us. Let's go to George listening to us in Shanahan, Illinois, on XM Satellite Radio. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Bruce.
Hello.
You know, we were talking, you guys were talking a while ago about, if you remember back to the other recessions, and I remember starting to listen to you in the 80s during the Reagan recession, or as I call it, the Reagan recession. But the reason I'm calling is I'd like to see if the government wants to come out and help us, but help us with our own money. I wish they'd enable us to do so. If they want to offer a stimulus, I'd like to see a forgiveness of the 10% withdrawal on your IRAs or your 401ks, allow people to have access to that money to either make a better deal for a new mortgage, buy down their mortgage. If they may have assets in the retirement savings just to pay their mortgage off in full and be done with it. Any credit card mitigation that you try to do, the first thing anybody will tell you to do is you take the biggest one with the biggest interest, pay it down quick, and get rid of it, and don't go back to the debt.
Jack, what do you think of this idea?
Which one of the five ideas? George, you mentioned several things there in rapid succession. Are you for the government bailing out people who made bad decisions?
No, what I'm saying is if the government wants to do something to stimulate us, okay?
The government wants to buy your votes. That's what the government always wants to do.
I thought the caller is making a very intelligent point. He's saying we may need to do some extraordinary things. One of the extraordinary things would be to allow you to use some of the money you've put aside already for a long-term problem to solve some short-term crisis that you might have. That sounds to me to be worth really seriously considering.
I think it's a great idea, the first idea. And I've read a couple articles on that before. It's been pitched before. And by the way, George, my brother Carlos lives in Shanahan, so it's not too many people I know even from that area. But that makes two.
So what happens,
I think it's a great
term.
Idea because, look, that is your own money. He's saying, how do I fix my problem with my own money? Right now I'm not able to access that money because I get penalized for it. If I can take my own money, I'm not asking the government for theirs. I'm asking for access to my own money and put it towards my own problem. How is that not actually something that Republicans should love and embrace?
Because you're moving the problem downstream. So when the baby boom bomb hits retirement and everyone's drained their equity, everyone's drained their houses, and now they drain their 401ks, and they're all going to hit Social Security, which is, what, $11 trillion in actuarial imbalance? What are they going to rely on?
Well, that's if you were to allow them to take it all. But let's say you do a $10,000. Let's say if you let people take a percentage of it, 10%, or let's say you have $100,000 and you're close to retirement. For you to be able to tap into $10,000 and pay off some massive credit card debt, that's a really good use of that money. It's already just disappearing right in front of your eyes every day. I stopped looking at mine. So I think George probably feels the same way. I'd like to be able to look at it and put it to good use.
Let's go to Dawn in Folsom, California, listening to us on KTKZ. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I'm calling mainly because I wanted to kind of send my cheers on to Rick on CNBC.
Santelli.
Yes,
Rick Santelli.
I happened to be watching him at that time. I get very frustrated at the people those of us that have done it right. We haven't lived over our means. We've kept cars for 10, 15 years.
You bought
now,
a dog, though.
Huh?
You bought a dog. I could hear her in the background.
Yes, I did. That's,
so, Dawn?
But you're right. 92% of the people are paying their mortgages on time.
That's exactly right. And I think the big thing that really gets me as I listen to when people are talking about that, they come back and say, well, the government bailed out the banks. And you know what? The government did, but the people, about 70% of the people, 60% of the people did not want that. They didn't want to bail out the banks. So the government did it anyway, and it didn't help because the government was a good part to blame for that wasn't just the banks. And now we seem to be going down the road of wanting to bail out. Now we'll be bailing out the automobile companies and now the home mortgages. And the rest of us who, you know, we were hit and we have to continue bailing everybody out. And as far as that stimulus package goes, I think it's a travesty.
I think you're speaking for a lot of people. I really do.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. I know I am for people around here. It's a travesty that the Democrats forced a vote and nobody read the stimulus bill.
I think that
everybody, if you're in Congress and you're going to vote us in.
Didn't Obama say he was going to put all the bills on online and let everyone read them for 5 days or 2 weeks? And
everything you're
didn't
saying.
Didn't that turn out to be a lie?
Everything you're saying is true. But there is a problem here, and we can't just kind of gloss over it, that there is a kind of freezing up of the economy and of credit. There's a real panic out there. So the question is, can we solve it in ways that don't reward bad behavior?
Now, that's something else because, and I feel, and I'm not alone here, that I really hold the media somewhat responsible because all you ever hear is how bad, bad, bad it is. Now, you know, you rarely hear people say 92% of the people are paying their mortgages. You rarely hear that.
That's why you have to watch Beyond the Beltway.
That's what Bruce is here for.
Well, that, no, but no, no, you're but you're right. But the other thing you hear is you see a lot of stories about people who are well intentioned and they got trapped. Mm-hmm. Maybe they didn't read the small print. You know, they are part of the foreclosure problem in America, and we hear sort of sad stories about them. And there are a lot of people who have made bad mistakes, but you know, you at some point you've got to learn from your mistakes. And if people are bailing you out, you don't learn very much from those mistakes. Listen, thank you very much, by the way, to you and anyone listening to us on KTKZ. The mayor of Sacramento, Kevin Johnson, is coming up on the radio portion the next hour of Beyond the Beltway. In hour number one, we've been joined by our Democrat, Susana Mendoza, Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago, and our Republican has been Jack McInerney. They will all be back for hour number two. If you're watching us on television, we'll see you next week. If you're listening to us on radio, the phone lines remain open at 1-800-723-8029. Callers on the line. We will hear from you and the mayor of Sacramento, California, in hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Don't go. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont. We continue with our second hour of Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics. Tonight featuring commentary by our Democrat, Susana Mendoza, our Republican, Jack McInerney, Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago, and our special guest in the next segment, Kevin Johnson, the mayor of Sacramento, California, former star with the Phoenix Suns, who's now the mayor of Sacramento. And Mr. Mayor, nice to have you with us on Beyond the Beltway.
Thanks, Bruce. It's a pleasure to be on.
I would like to mention to our national audience that this past Friday, along with about 79 other mayors from coast to coast, you were in to see the President and Vice President of the United States talking about the $787 billion stimulus package. And my question to you is, which is a question that we've talked about on this program, and that is, why is a mayor in a better position to determine where money should go, because generally speaking, the stimulus money is going to flow through the governors and the state legislature?
Yeah, very good question. I think, first of all, by President Obama reaching out directly to hear from mayors, it shows his commitment to getting dollars pumped into the local economy so we as mayors can put people back to work as quickly as possible. I think, to your point, cities and local governments have a better ability to move on projects immediately and make those dollars actually stimulate the economy. If those dollars are stuck in state agencies, then we lose time and have less ability to get those dollars to our top priorities in our communities, which are certainly jobs.
Now, we have an electorate now in this country that is very leery of anything that any politician says, and some of them may be speaking back to their radio as you responded to that first question, and they would say, well, but does a mayor only pick projects because someone involved in that project is a campaign supporter of that mayor or the governor? It really could be for either party.
That's an Illinois question.
Go ahead.
Am I answering that or somebody?
Yes, no, you're answering it, Mr. Mayor.
All right. So let me tell you how we do it in Sacramento. We have a list of our top priorities and projects in Sacramento, as well as our county and our region. So there's three lists that we compiled in terms of when the federal government came out with the original guidelines. It was really about infrastructure projects that were shovel ready. And a way to weight the projects were how many people can you put to work based on creating jobs and how quickly can you do that. So it really was for us about infrastructure, it was about transportation, it was about flood and repairing our levees. And those are public work projects, really. They're not projects that benefit individuals or private corporations in many cases.
In the first hour, we were also talking on the program about when people think about public works projects and the stimulus package, they think of primarily construction jobs, i.e. blue-collar jobs. What in the stimulus package, the dollars of which may flow through Sacramento, California, is there anything that's going to stimulate white-collar jobs?
Well, I think, you know, the great thing that, that happened here, the brilliance of the economic stimulus package, you know, it started again. We needed to do public work projects. And what President Obama and his administration did is they said, look, we have foreclosure challenges, so we need to invest dollars through the Secretary of HUD to make sure public housing and foreclosures and assisting housing are getting dollars. So $13 billion are going to housing type of projects. He also said education is going to be important, and we're losing jobs. I mean, there's going to be X amount of teachers that were going to be losing their jobs around the country. So he ended up putting $50 billion that will go to states to make sure that we can keep people hired, and that's the middle class, and that's what's ultimately more important. Within the middle class, you certainly have, you know, white-collar jobs as well.
Our Republican in the table here in Chicago is Jack McInerney. He has a question for you, Mr. Mayor.
Mayor Johnson, one word, mandates. I teach part-time at a community college, and I am a member of the NEA. Are you at all concerned about taking any of the education part of the money and having mandates that you will be forced to raise taxes for 2, 3, 4 years down the road?
Yeah, Jack, we don't want to be in that position. Arne Duncan spoke briefly, again, to all of us mayors last week at the White House and talked about really giving us maximum flexibility in terms of how to spend those dollars. And those dollars were in the three buckets. There was early childhood, K-12, and higher ed. And those are certainly, you know, high priorities for all of us. But the challenge is to make sure that the dollars don't get stuck in red tape in the bureaucratic process at the state level, that they get down to the local levels of us mayors. And we don't have as much discretion once they get to us.
Now, also, we should mention that the state of California finally reached, passed their budget and their spending plan. And my question to you is, with all of the things that are part of that package, including a temporary sales tax, a 1 cent on a dollar sales tax, you've got a spending cap of 5%. There are 6 ballot measures that are going to the polls on May 19th, so the voters are going to determine on some of these issues. There'll also be a 0.25% surcharge on personal income tax. The cost of going to college is going up. There's no cost of increase for people who want welfare. And again, how many jobs are being cut from the state government?
Well, with all that you said, it seems like I should leave the state of California.
Well, especially you're the mayor of the capital city, so you got a real big problem.
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, being the capital city of California, 7th largest, 8th largest economy in the world, our city is impacted locally much more so than other cities throughout the state. And, you know, when there wasn't a budget passed, it was like a wrecking ball into our local economy. You had furloughs on the first and third Friday of each month. People that would normally shop at our, stay at our hotels, shop retail, and shop at our businesses and things like that, we're not doing that. We're a government town. We have about 27,000 workers that work for the state of California in our city and our region, and certainly it impacted us a great deal. Now that the budget's balanced, not only are those people going to be able to continue to work, but secondly, a lot of projects that I talked about earlier, transportation, flood, and some other infrastructure projects, will now continue on. All those projects were on hold. Our unemployment rate in Sacramento a year ago was 5.6%. We're at 8.7% and climbing toward double digits, and that's just not a good thing for our local economy.
But again, how many jobs were ultimately cut? Because I guess some voters would say, you know what, maybe it isn't a good idea to have full employment of state workers in Sacramento. It may be good for you, the mayor of Sacramento, but maybe it isn't good for the state budget because some of those jobs really should be cut.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many jobs ultimately were cut from the last proposal that was passed.
Now, in the stimulus package, California is going to end up with $26 billion. Is it too early to tell how much of that might trickle down to Sacramento?
Yeah, it's too early because the way the formula works, unfortunately, the state gets about 50% of those dollars, and then you get a two-third that goes to the city and a third goes to back to the state. So the state actually gets a chance to double dip. So we as mayors are not pleased with that funding formula. And then secondly, I have no idea yet what percentage Sacramento will get as opposed to some other states in California. We do know that California is going to receive the largest, if not the largest, economic stimulus dollar package that's going to go to the state of California. So we as cities are very well and primed and positioned to really put people to work. They're trying to get those dollars out of Washington in the next 2 to 4 weeks, which is very, very significant. That's why the project had to be shovel ready.
Mr. Mayor, we thank you very much. I understand you've got to move on to another appointment. We thank you very much, and hopefully when we head out to Sacramento to do our show from KTKZ Live, we'll have you in the studio and enjoy your fine city.
Hey,
I think
Bruce,
you should
Bruce,
get
I'm
more
you
money for being able to play basketball with the president.
Hey, Bruce, I'm going to hold
Hi,
you
Mr.
to
Mayor,
that.
Hi, Mr. Mayor. You're fabulous.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Okay, thank you very much. That's Kevin Johnson, the mayor of Sacramento, California. From Fresno, California to Seattle, Washington, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8289. Eduardo has been patient. He's been listening to us on our flagship station, WLS Radio in Chicago. Go ahead, Eduardo.
Yeah, thank you very much. I think the banks are the only ones that should be bailed out. I think, you know, the governors were complaining that some of them are not going to take the money. It's probably a good reason because Mayor Daley's probably going to use that money for the Olympics instead of using it for more police. We just had a killing of three people over the weekend. So,
I think the most important thing is we want to know, you know, where he's going to spend the money. I think it's important that in this era of transparency, which has really been articulated by the president of the United States, I think we want transparency everywhere, and there shouldn't be any secret lists, and I think there also should be some real serious investigation into whether or not there's any political contributions that shore up this money when it's loosed.
Eduardo's in Chicago, and unfortunately, in Chicago, there's less and less places to spend on infrastructure because we have a city council and a mayor who's selling everything off, from roads to airports to parking meters to everything, that the city of Chicago literally may not have streets or sidewalks left by the time this administration gets through with it.
Thanks for your call. Let's go to Mike in Sacramento listening to us on KTKZ. Go ahead, Mike. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. I just want you to know I'm a supporter of the mayor who was just on. But I'm an observer from California for a long time, and there was a time when everybody could just get work. But the government of the state of California, the legislature, has basically destroyed the climate for people to have jobs. The jobs have gone to Taiwan, China, Arizona. They're just going everywhere.
What have they done, Mike?
Well, first of all, heavy taxation and overregulation. As a teacher, I don't run into these people a lot, but I've run into many, many, many people on their way out of California. They say they can't survive here business-wise, so they take their business and their jobs with them.
What do you teach, Mike?
I'm an art teacher.
And are those the kind of jobs which a lot of schools are now saying, oh, gee, we need to put all of our money into math and we need to put it into reading, and art teachers are something you see less and less of? Is your job vulnerable?
Actually, mine went down the tubes because of that very thing. So I'm looking now, but I'll be teaching again somewhere. But they're decimating the arts.
I appreciate your call. We move on to KLBJ, Austin, Texas. Mike is listening to us. Go ahead, Mike.
Hey, yeah, Bruce, love your show. Probably the best political show I think on the radio anywhere. And
we love Mike.
Mike, go ahead. Take the rest of the hour.
Mike, you are an acute observer.
You're an acute observer.
Mike, can you speak up? I didn't hear you.
You've got a lovely wife and children,
yeah,
Michael.
What was that?
All right, go ahead, Mike.
We love your dog, too.
Go ahead, Mike.
First of all, it just really, I get livid when I hear these mayors and congressmen and governors and all these people getting on the television and everywhere just talking about how they're going to spend my money like they deserve it. I just get livid when I see that happening. You know, I haven't missed a mortgage payment in 15 years. I've kept my bills paid up. You know, I keep all my credit cards paid off. And my wife and I have, you've heard this story, we've made sacrifices so that we can stay in our home and keep our bills paid up and keep a good credit rating. You know, we just bought a new car. We're not participating in this recession right now. But what gets me is that the government won't let me take my own money, like you were talking about earlier,
right,
taking a chunk of my 401k money that I've saved up over 25 years of working.
Actually, you can use that money. You just have to pay a tax penalty that you avoided in the first place of putting it in, correct?
You bet I can take it, but the government's going to charge me out the wazoo to get it.
Right, but you paid up the wazoo earlier, or you pay up now. The reason you have that money there is you were not taxed on it in the first place when you put it into a retirement fund, like a Roth IRA or something like that, correct? So if you're allowed to take it, what essentially is happening is people are avoiding taxes, avoiding income taxes.
Tax. He would be taxed on it as income once he takes it out.
Right.
And he's paying a penalty. And I understand his point. Right.
Yeah. I would totally be for not paying the penalty. But, you know, should you allow people to avoid taxes?
No, well, he's not saying that. He's saying he just wants access to his own money without having to get socked with a major penalty. I'm totally with that. I think it's a great idea.
Go ahead, Mike.
What's the difference in letting somebody get a mortgage for 2 or 3% cheaper than what they're getting now and giving me a tax break on my own money? They're going to let these people refinance their own mortgages.
But the mortgage
payment is going to drop. Why can't I take care of my own self, take my own money out, pay my mortgage off, and then take that $1,300 a month and put it into a Roth, which is exactly what I would do?
I think everything you're saying makes good sense. Let me ask you one question, though, that the value of your house, which is for most of us a significant portion of what we have, is imperiled if the six of your neighbors on your block go into foreclosure.
Absolutely.
And so you've got a stake in that. And I'm just wondering, you're doing the right thing, but you're imperiled if the economy really tanks. What are your thoughts about that?
You mean if everybody in my neighborhood?
I mean, what I'm saying is if there's massive unemployment, if people can't meet their payments, in other words, if not if people are just irresponsible, but if the economy itself is in very bad shape, it puts you in a worse position as well. Do you have thoughts about that?
Well, sure. It puts me in a better position if I lose my job if my house is paid for. That's the way I look at it. You know, the economy's in the crapper anyway.
There are people who took mortgages, 90% mortgages on condos in California that were $380,000. These condos have been appraised at $160,000. That's what's known as being underwater by a significant amount.
Blub, blub, blub.
If the market – thank you for the sound effect. If the market – if these people stop paying their mortgages and the market is just flooded, what you've been paying for 15 years on your mortgage, what happens if the equity in your house gets cut, not by 40 or 50, but by 70%? What are your thoughts on then not bailing out any of your neighbors who went into their mortgages with very good intentions?
Right, and actually didn't go into some sort of a good deal for them. They went in with all the right reasons, for all the right reasons, and for whatever reason now, because the economy is so bad, lost their job.
All right, let's let Mike respond. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, at least I have a house to live in. You know, these people, you know, for whatever their circumstances, they may have lost their homes, lost their jobs, whatever. You know, there's not much I can do about that, but if I would be allowed to pay my house off with money that I've saved, then at least I'm being a part of the solution in my mind. I'm not a part of the problem.
What is the role of government?
Well, I want to praise you in one sense. I think that this sense of self-reliance is something that we have lost and are continuing to lose in the country, and I think it's a very important voice.
But politically speaking, I think the frustration that we hear in Mike's voice, and the frustration we heard at the beginning of the show from Rick Santelli of CNBC, that is a real spark. That is a spark that I think has already been heard, and it's one that can lead to a populist revolt, that can lead to a significant change for the Republicans in 2 years.
Let's hope so,
because they will be infuriated by the perception that somebody's getting away with nothing, even though the reality is maybe the number of people who are getting away with nothing is a much smaller
figure. I think that's exactly right, and I think it's compounded by the fact that the government, which is coming in and saying we can save everything, did a lot to create these problems.
Yeah, let's remember it was the Bush government that did that. Pin that at all on Obama trying to make things better at this
did
point.
Did what?
When we're talking about that government is responsible for getting
but
us in the situation that we're in today.
The Senate and the House.
I would just like to remind us that we've
Clinton
been in office for maybe like 2 months now. So.
We're turning Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac into a social experiment.
Well, I don't think it was the Democrats that were saying that we should not have any type of oversight or regulation. And so that is what has brought us to this point today. And we should remember that President Obama has been in office for, 2 months plus? I mean,
name a time?
It's easy to forget those Bush days.
Can you name a time in recorded history that any government has ever regulated itself to financial safety since the year zero? There's not one recorded case if you read Greenspan's book.
No. The SEC
name one
did
time.
A good job. Once it was initially set up in preventing the kind of massive fraud that we saw for things like Bernie Madoff and now this guy down in Houston and so forth. And a lot of those go back even before the Bush administration. This is the
federal, not
the Bush administration. This is the basic government agencies that are supposed to do this.
But I think the people that are listening, I think they're fed up, whether it's the Republicans or the Democrats.
Right. We just need to find solutions to this.
Exactly.
Because the reality is, in our memory, the short-term memory, the bailout of the banks – We have executives of our government at the executive level, at the congressional level, giving $350 billion out to banks, and they don't know what happened to the money with no strings attached.
But again,
that's everybody. That's a bipartisan.
Right.
That isn't just Bush, and it isn't just the Democrats.
There's a panic and a fury out in the country, and I'm sure you feel it as a representative.
And people should be outraged by it. No question about it. We got to pause. 1-800-723-8289. Lots of callers on the line. We have touched a nerve, and we'll bring them into the conversation when we roll on from XM Satellite Radio Studios in Chicago's Great West Side. From Worcester, Mass. To Grand Rapids, Michigan, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Our Democrat tonight is Susana Mendoza. She is an Illinois state representative, and she's a member of the International Trade and Public Utility Committee and also was a member of the House Impeachment Committee that led to the impeachment of Rod Blagojevich and then the conviction by a vote of 59-0 of Rod Blagojevich following his arrest, along with John Harris, his chief of staff. And she joins us tonight. And again, she was the one of the very first Democrats to call for the resignation of Roland Burris. Others have followed in her stead, along with Jack Franks. And they're also, where do you come down on the call for a special election so that in the future, if there is a vacancy, the voters will decide, not a future governor?
Yeah, the first time we talked about it, I was actually against a special election, given the district that I represent. It's not a rich district, and I had a hard time explaining to them why we should spend $50 million on a special election. Having seen the consequences of that now and seeing that this did not end with Rod Blagojevich, but now we're living through the Roland Burris saga, I think at this point I would absolutely entertain the thought of a special election. I would give it very serious consideration, and I'm frankly leaning towards being in strong support of a special election should that be necessary.
And again, you've called for the resignation of Roland Burris.
Yes.
Because you feel he did not tell the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth when he appeared before your committee.
Under oath, yes.
Under oath. That is our Democrat tonight, Susana Mendoza. Very refreshing. Republican Jack McInerney also joins us. He ran for lieutenant governor how many years ago, Jack?
Seven.
7 years ago, that's correct. He is the president of...
Thank you.
It was trivia.
I'm also a math teacher part-time.
He is also a television executive and a television producer, and also you're an expert in computer science and technology and all things technical.
And I also agree with Susanna that Roland Burr should resign.
Charles
and he did
Lipson
lie.
Is also here. You agree with that as well?
I agree, and I strongly support a special election. People ought to have a choice here.
And he is from the University of Chicago for the last 32 years. Lots of callers on the line. I mentioned Boise, Idaho. Let's head there now. Mike is listening to us on the blowtorch of Boise, KBOI. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
How are things in Idaho tonight?
Oh, we're doing good out here.
Terrific.
We're
it's
gonna,
a beautiful state.
We're going to turn down some of that federal bribe money.
Okay.
I got two questions. Mm-hmm. Why should anybody in the rest of the country believe that all of the politicians from Illinois aren't crooked? And my second question is on the Obama budget coming in, he's gonna raise the deficit by $1.5 trillion, and then he's gonna cut it in half, and we're gonna end up with an $800 billion deficit, which is 100% more than it was last year. And how is that a cut?
It's not.
This is Jack McInerney talking. Go ahead, Jack. Take the second part of the question.
Sure.
Then I want Susanna to comment on the first one.
Sure. In the Great Depression, a lot of people forget how bad it really was. The city of Toledo at the depth had an unemployment rate of 90%, if you can imagine that, a city with an unemployment rate of 90%. During the natural course of economics, and my ranking professor from the University of Chicago may collaborate this, I only teach at a community college part-time, is that the natural order is mild deflation. Only when the Dutch gave us paper money have we had a consistent rate of inflation. Well, every once in a while, regardless of printing money, you get a deflationary cycle, and it is the one time where you could actually print money without an inflationary aspect to it. And that is what I think they're trying to do. As the president has pointed out, we've had $1 trillion to $2 trillion of consumption taken out of the economy. We have, what, a $14 trillion economy? So when you have that type of absence of consumption, you have massive deflation. It's the one time you can actually print money if you're careful about it and not cause too much harm.
And the first part of your question to Susanna Mendoza, who was here, why should anyone believe any politician from Illinois?
Well, I think the question was that why should they believe that every single one of us is not corrupt, you know? It goes further than why should they just believe us.
Right.
But I think because it's like anything else in life. I mean, you have good people and you have some bad people. And unfortunately, in politics, and definitely with the embarrassment that we've lived with Rod Blagojevich and now with the junior senator from Illinois, Roland Burris, we've given people plenty of reasons to believe that it's okay to lose absolute faith in politicians and in what we represent. And so I am saddened to hear that. I'm sure there are plenty of people who think that all Illinois politicians are corrupt, but it's like saying that all teachers are bad or all police officers are bad when there's one or two bad apples in the bunch. And
but
so
we've lost our last two governors.
We have, but and you,
our
we
governors
have,
print
but
your license plates.
Every right.
We have, but I will say that it's not fair though to paint a broad brush on all of us. I know there's certainly
every.
I would say that I am not corrupt, and I believe a lot of the colleagues that I work with are not corrupt, and I have a lot of faith in them from both parties, not just the Democratic Party, but also Republicans who are good people. So we need to win back the people's trust. And, you know, the most I can do is try the hardest I can. And hopefully someday my friend from Idaho will think that maybe this politician is not corrupt and you give us a shot.
And by the way, I just want to say for those that may have tuned in and did not hear my comment a little bit earlier, last week on a local television show, Susanna Mendoza was there. She was sitting next to one of her colleagues in the Illinois House, Monique Davis. And she basically came out and said that Roland Burris basically should resign because he had not lived up to the oath that he took in front of her committee. Now, this is a member of the General Assembly, not in leadership. This took tremendous courage for her to stand up on a television show and say for two consecutive nights that the junior United States Senator, a Democrat, should resign. Now, after she did that, the governor agreed a couple of days later. The state treasurer agreed. The state comptroller agreed. Now you have the United States Senate, Harry Reid and Dick Durbin. They're not quite there yet, but they're getting ready to maybe make the same call. You have the press secretary to the president of the United States suggesting that Roland Burris, you know, spend a lot of time this weekend thinking about maybe doing the right thing. And what I'm saying is this is one state representative, a Democrat, challenging a Democrat on television. Now, that takes guts. It takes courage. And, again, I'm telling you, I'm sharing with the audience things, something that I've said to you directly, Susanna, because I think it was one of the great acts of political courage that I've seen in 35 years of political coverage. You put your career on the line, and I'm sure there's been some heat to you by what you did, because you know what you did? You stood up and you said publicly that a fellow Democrat had done something that was basically unethical, and because of that should resign. And you also said that because people in elected officials as well as parents are supposed to teach their children to tell the truth. Well, if politicians look the other way when another politician does not tell the truth, what signal does that send? And what we have here tonight is we have a Democrat who's concerned about the rule of law and telling the truth. How refreshing it is. How refreshing it is to have an elected Democrat say what Susanna Mendoza has said. And
so
I congratulate you again
for
what you said. And again, that doesn't mean we don't have a lot of bad apples in Illinois. We do, but they're not all bad apples. Let's go to John listening to us in Crete on WLS Radio. John, are you there? Let's go to Jerry in Evanston, Illinois. Go ahead.
Thank you, Bruce. You and the politician called in from California, the mayor, touched on one of the key problems.
Mm-hmm.
His comment was he's hoping that the money that comes from the federal government doesn't get caught in some of the state bureaucracy and red tape and gets to the cities. What I'd ask you to do is challenge every politician that comes on there and ask them, why do we continue to have the bloated bureaucracies, the payrollers, the people who sit around and collect huge salaries, huge pension plans that are not productive and that we could easily get rid of and suffer no loss in services. Every time I see a politician on TV, they're surrounded by their entourage, by 20, 30, 40 people. Every one of those guys is making $70,000, $100,000, $150,000 a year and up. Every one of them has a bloated pension program, and it's outright theft of the American people. And what I would recommend people do is the next time there's an election, don't reelect anybody, because they're all part of the huge mess that we have on our hands and that we're paying for.
I'm going to challenge what you just said, because to elect everyone, which is the tendency, or to reelect everyone, which is the tendency in our government, I agree with you, that's a bad idea. And I also agree that just automatically throwing all the rascals out, or anyone who's an incumbent, throwing them out, that's an easy way out as well. There is a responsibility. We're talking about responsibility of elected officials tonight. The responsibility is of voters to spend some time to learn who the politicians are, and to look at their records and not be swayed by political commercials, so you don't get seduced and you don't get hammered like Rod Blagojevich hammered Judy Bartopinka in the last gubernatorial campaign, where one candidate was without question incredibly had brought great integrity to her career, and the other one, basically, as we now know, was a lying sack of you-know-what, and the voters voted for the lying sack of you-know-what. So you know what? People get the government they elect. Don't forget it. From Texarkana, Texas to Cucamonga, California, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Let's head to Louisville, Kentucky, where Greg is listening to us on WLS. Go ahead, Greg.
Hi, guys. I'd like to ask the lady representative. I'm an Illinois native. I live in lovingly in tax-free Tennessee. We have no state income tax, thank God. And I want to ask you one question, and then I want to ask you a second question, if I may.
Sure.
The first question has to do with Roland Burris. If he testified before the Illinois legislature and basically lied, can you not get him on perjury?
Well, that's one of the things that's being investigated by the Sangamon County State's Attorney. Actually, Speaker Madigan forwarded, and so did the Attorney General, all of the affidavits that he presented before our committee. Now, it's important to keep in mind that they're going to look into the potential of a perjury investigation, But some experts have said that it's not even close to perjury. Others have said that it is. And I think it's somewhere maybe in between. But here's my point. It doesn't matter if he legally perjured himself or not. There's a difference between lying and actual legal terminology when it comes to perjury. But there's no doubt that he lied. So I just think that you should not be allowed to be a U.S. senator who's a former attorney general, come before an impeachment committee, swear under oath to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, and then lie. So I think that the bar has been set way too low for U.S. congressmen of this nature, where it's okay for him to continue to be congressman because technically, I mean, a senator, because technically he may not have perjured himself. Okay, let's break it down. He lied. He needs to go.
Susanna?
Okay.
As a Republican.
Go ahead, Greg.
Go ahead,
Greg.
Jack, and then we're going to go back to Greg. Go ahead, Jack.
As a lifelong Democrat and an elected Democrat, do you think Bill Clinton should have resigned when he lied to the American public?
I don't think Bill Clinton should have lied to the American public. And, yes, I think he should have resigned. I think there's a lot of people that should resign when they lie. They look you in the eye and they lie under oath. Now, we know that wasn't the case. That didn't happen. But, you know, today is a new day. I'm an elected official today, and I had to take a position on the issue, and I've taken it.
Greg, back to you.
Okay. And regarding your district where you said you had stores closing and businesses shuttering and things of that nature, as I said, I'm an Illinois native, and I'm still very fond of my home state, but you couldn't pay me to live in Illinois and bring my business to Illinois. Your taxes are atrocious. Your property taxes are atrocious. Your business climate is atrocious. If you want to solve your problem in your neighborhood, I'm going to challenge you to go to Springfield and introduce a bill in the state legislature to get off the back of your businesses in that state. You want jobs to come back to Illinois, cut the state taxes on business, and watch them come running in the droves.
As a matter of fact, I have a bill that I filed that is in the Rules Committee. Well, actually, it's in the Revenue Committee, which might as well be the Rules Committee, where it's not going anywhere. And it does provide tax cuts and incentives to emerging technology businesses. That actually covers a whole gamut of really good, high-paying jobs that I think in the long run would be really great for Illinois. We're not going to move it this year, but I am definitely of the same mentality that you are in that respect, even as a Democrat.
Wherever you're listening this evening, there are 43 states that currently are dealing with budgets that are going to require either a significant cut in programs or tax hikes. 43 of the 50 states. Next week, I'll try to name the seven states or find for you the seven states that somehow have avoided this.
Tennessee is one of them.
But in the state of Illinois, based on the stimulus package, we talked about California getting $26 billion. That is the most. They are the largest state, so they get the most. Illinois is sixth ranked, and they will get $8.8 billion. And yet, there's going to be a call for increased state taxes in addition to the $8.8 billion. What can you tell us about the likely increase in taxes in Illinois, and why are those taxes needed if there's going to be $8.8 billion flowing from the stimulus package?
Well, I think primarily because even though it's $8.8 billion flowing from the stimulus package, it doesn't all go towards settling our debt. And we have a $9 billion deficit that we're, you know, talking about right now in Illinois. It's the worst financial situation our state has ever been in since 1818. And frankly, we have got big problems ahead of us. So right now, I don't know what type of taxes will be potentially looked at to be raised, but it is definitely, I'd be lying if I sat here and said that it's not something that is on the table.
And it's a serious issue at the city level as well. Every one of those empty storefronts you're talking about used to be paying in sales taxes. It went right into the city.
But
our sales taxes are now over 10%. How can you raise them?
And
that's a county tax.
For those,
county tax.
Susanna, for those listening within the sound of our voice on WLS, our flagship station, is the gubernatorial infrastructure, is his brain trust sufficiently up to speed? Because they're relatively new in the mechanics of state government. Are they up to speed as to how this money is to be spent? Because the feds have basically said, we want you to spend the money fast, and if you don't spend the money fast, you may lose it.
Yeah, I think they're working around the clock, and they're getting there. I mean, we keep in mind when Governor Blagojevich left, he gave absolutely zero assistance to now Governor Quinn during the transition period. We had no idea even what our honest-to-God deficit was. So we're there now. The budget address, which was supposed to happen February 18th, was moved up, moved back, I should say, a month. So we'll have all the facts and figures March 18th, and I can guarantee you that Governor Quinn, I'm sure, is working around the clock, putting his staff together and getting us all the numbers that we need to move forward.
Susanna, what about the over $100 billion of unfunded liabilities, i.e. state promises, especially the pensions? We are either 49th or 50th.
Yes.
And every governor for the last 40 years and every legislature, namely Mike Madigan, has underfunded our pensions.
Mike Madigan is the Speaker of the House.
He
for those listening around the country who don't know that name. Mike Madigan. He's also the chairman of the Illinois Democratic Party. On that note, we want to say thanks to Jack McInerney, our Republican this evening, for joining us. And also our Democrat is Susanna Mendoza. She is an Illinois state representative, a member of the House Impeachment Committee, who was called for the resignation of Roland Burris as the junior United States Senator from Illinois for not telling the truth under oath when he appeared before her committee, chaired by Barbara Flynn Curry. And also joining us this evening has been Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago. Thank you all for being with us tonight. Our thanks to Tom Veracruz and the ever-popular Ben Stewart for their assistance in the production of this program. Was produced by Jenny B. Production and WLS Talk Radio in Chicago. From Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.